you know, we want to try and lessen our own ridiculous nonsense for our sake. So we continue with our mind, but here now it's in reference to how to help others, how the effect on this planet, how to help the world. So compassion must be based on wisdom, it's in ethics. Essentially, it's karma is ethics. Karma is abiding by the laws of karma, is abiding, is not doing negative things, it harms others because it creates causes for your future suffering. So it's basic ethics. So you've got this. So this one of how all beings have been kind, very powerful. So what it's helping us do, this third point, is again expand our mind to encompass, to recognise and countless sentient beings. You know, just the number of things that you need in one day to live, you probably count them as a sentient being as you start. So we never think of that because we're only seeking through the lens of attachment. I'm prepared to thank the cook if they do a nice job. I'm prepared to thank the waitress if they do a nice job. But then there'll be all the others even behind that. We never think of them because we see everything through the lens of our own needs. So here, you know, there's countless sentient beings involving every tiny thing that facilitates our life. So really the way of saying this particular contemplation, you know, is that since the time we're conceived up to now, everything that is facilitated in our life is the handiwork of countless sentient beings. Countless. That's a fact. You can't deny it. It's just that we never pay attention to it. We don't care. We don't care if we know them. Mm-hmm. So the culmination, the conclusion, what comes from these kind of contemplations, opening up our mind to this reality, when it becomes genuine for us, is that, you know, in the same way that a mother, like my mother, I know she kept everything her children ever made. And whenever she saw some dumb looking drawing made by one of her kids, she didn't see a dumb drawing. She just, that drawing was like a vivid manifestation of her precious baby. And that's the way bodhisattvas would be. Everything they see is the handiwork of sentient beings, like as if it's their most precious children who made it. So it brings us, it's just a method of hugely expanding our mind to recognize that this our lives are built on the backs of sentient beings. So then you over the next step, number four, is the conclusion, I must repay the kindness. That's how we thought about lunch a couple of times. Not just some vague, useless kind of thoughts. They're genuine. They're valid. This is provable, you know. We just don't think it. We don't care. And if the lunch is nice, we're prepared to thank you. If not, thank you very much. You know, I don't deserve it. So this is just expanding our mind. We need to recognize that what's staring right in front of us is my glasses, that marble, this cloth, the microphone, the floor, everything is the handiwork of sentient beings. And this is the basis of my survival. So how kind. How kind I must, before I must be paid the kindness. So the next few techniques would culminate in the accomplishment of bodhicitta from the tradition that's known as this tradition that is the one of transforming problems into happiness. And it's called, another way of calling it is this whole approach we're now trying to do is make this paradigm shift of not only expanding our own sense of self to encompass others, but to actually go even further and do what they call exchange ourself for others. Exchange ourself for others. So okay, just using terminology here that you see in all the literature. In the first stages of practice, attachment to my needs is the main problem. But here it's framed in a different way. It's called self-charity. It's not a phrase we use in English, but just we'd say selfish. And it's a bit sort of mean if someone says you're so selfish, you get very offended. But what it means is inexorably and inevitably, because we go grasping an attachment, of course we put self first. It's deeply primordial and spontaneous. So in this, particularly in the bodhisattva wing, we're trying to counteract that, and we're literally here at this level of practice is trying to make this paradigm shift where we're now trying to cherish others more than self. You know, it's kind of radical. There's more of these several steps. But they culminate in this one called you've accomplished this bodhicitta. The technique that's most known well, you know it's more with practices and things, that is used is the culmination of these practices. You go to this fourth point to then seeing that others are equal to me, then seeing that others are more important than me, then developing love, developing great love, developing great compassion, and then bodhicitta. It goes in this order. So the technique that's used especially, and it's kind of a real favourite among all the Tibetans, and it's said to be the key technique for really exchanging self for others, is this technique that's known in Tibetan as Tonglen. As far as modern people love it, I'm very surprised, and it's quite outrageous practice. What it is not, you know, so you've got compassion, okay? Compassion is, oh well, I'm going to give that person a headache, I'm so sorry, you have empathy. Then great compassion is, What can I do to help? How can I help you? Well, it's tong len, which means giving, taking. Tibetans are very efficient in their language. They don't have and the. They don't have commas. Very kind of efficient kind of language. Even all their words are just syllables. And then you string together two or three other syllables, each of which is a word, to construct other words. It's very kind of, it's very nice. I don't speak it, but that much I know. So tong len means actually giving, taking. So this practice, for example, a person with a headache, first you have compassion, then you think great compassion, what can I do to help? But this next one's like cream on the top, it's like icing on the top, compassion. It goes, I'd rather have the headache, give it to me. So what this looks like is like you do it as a formal practice, using your breath. So simply speaking, you're imagining a person with a headache, you know. So when you breathe out, when you breathe in first, you visualize, you imagine breathing in their pain, their suffering, their torment. Whatever it is, it's a headache even. You imagine breathing it in, like yucky smoke. And you imagine all sorts of ways this can be done. You can create your own ways of doing it. It's just a way of thinking. And then you can imagine like your own self-cherishing, your own self-centered, like a little rock at your heart. When you breathe in, it kind of chips away at your self-cherishing. And then when you breathe out, you imagine giving them your health, your happiness, all your good qualities. So what's the attitude here? So this is the giving part is where you're practicing love. Because love is making me happy. Then this next attitude is what can I do to make you happy? And you know what? I'll give you my happiness. I'll give you my good qualities. And then taking is the practice of compassion. You see the suffering. You don't want them to have suffering. What can I do to help? Well, give it to me. I'd rather suffer than you. Now that we know with parents, they have that. You hear many times. Parents would rather have the suffering than the baby. You know? Well, that's what we're trying to cultivate here with all sentient beings. And this is the most outrageous practice. It's like the culmination that gets you finally to bodhicitta when you make this shift, you know. And people go off into retreat and do these for years. But to hear them in actual words, it's quite shocking to do it this way, in the ordinary world, you know. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about this practice. Sometimes people think of it as a healing practice. No, it's not really healing. This is a practice for you. This is you cultivating the courage to dare to think the thought, I would rather have the suffering than you. You're not, so the one, it's not a healing technique. Two, you're not trying to get a headache. That's ridiculous. I'm breathing in a headache. I failed. I didn't get a headache. It's not the point. This is a mental thing. It's an attitude. It's a courageous attitude of imagining if you could, you would rather than have the headache than them. It's not that you want a headache. It's not the point that you want them to be free of the headache. So it's a powerful technique, very personal technique in your meditation, and you don't know, to help smash ego grasping and attachment and self-centeredness. It's just a technique. It's a method for you to lessen neuroses. So of course you do these practices according to your capability. You're going to be a suitable vessel. It's very outrageous. So I always like to tell this story about our friend Harry. I mentioned Harry before, an American. He's one of our friends. He's been a meditator for years and years and years. He's got his own cave way up in the mountains near Lone Lotus Place. He is now in Washington State, so it's meditating there or somewhere. Whatever. But anyway, if anybody knows Harry, people always say, oh, Harry's a bodhisattva. I don't know, no idea, but when I hear this story, I think he must be something. He must have done some work, inner work, serious meditating, serious practice. When you meet him, you know, he's just this happy, jolly fellow. He's got a big beard, he's always smiling and funny and humble and ordinary. He's like a friendly fellow, you know, it's very interesting. They all say in all the texts and the practices, the more advanced you become, as a bodhisattva, as a person who's realized interest, as a yogi, the more ordinary you appear. You know, the more ordinary, the more simple, the more easygoing, not like some hoity-toity fancy person. So Harry's a very good example of that. Everybody adores Harry. Everybody loves Harry, you know. I'll tell you this story I found very powerful. I always tell this one. He's been meditating up there for years and years. So anyway, he was in Kathmandu at our monastery, Kopan. We go there first on our pilgrimage in October. It's my emergency again. Where are the postcards? So we go to Kopan. We start at Kopan first. And people love Kopan monasteries. It's where Lama Zabarangi started in the 70s, in the early 70s. You know. Now it's a monastery of like 500 or 600 monks. Just down the road there's 500 or 600 nuns. Really amazing place. Every year we go there. And we start our pilgrimage there. So anyway, Harry was at Koh Phang, and Lama Geshe was there, and Lama Zopa was there. This must be the early 80s, because Lama Geshe was still there. He passed away in 84. So Harry was planning to go up to his cave and meditate, which is way up near Lama Zopa. You know, if you walk all the way to the top, maybe it's a 10-day walk. If you fly to Rupa, it's like a 4-day walk, which is what we do on our trek in March. That's one thing. The pilgrimage is another in October. The pilgrimage raises money for our prison project, and the trek raises money for Lama Zopa's monastery. So anyway, Harry was preparing to go on this trek up to the mountains to meditate. And then Lama Zopa heard he was going, and then he said that he had a dream that Harry would die, so not to go. He had a message to him, but it was too late. Of course, they don't have mobiles those days, so it didn't happen. That's not Lama Geshe. Sorry, wrong story. That was before. This is Lama Zopa's story. Sorry, forgive me. Lama Zopa. Lama Geshe's father. So it's 90s. So Lama Zopa said this. Well, my extra comment here is Lama Zopa was never asleep, so it can't have been a dream. So it's obviously his clairvoyance. But he just says, he wants to be humble and not show. You know, he never shows he's got that. But clearly, if he's at who he is, he's got this quality. See your mind, see the past, know who you are, know your karma, their capacity. This is a low level realization. Edginess Bodhicitta comes way after that. So anyway, they couldn't get the message, Harry gone. So he asked Geshe Lama Khonsa, this amazing yogi who spent years in the mountains and spent his last 20 years at Koh Phang, to pray for Harry. So, anyway, I heard the story from the other nun who was with Harry years later. And then I asked Harry himself and he explained what happened. What happened was he's going up the mountain and at a certain point some of the road was blocked. So he had to go this very treacherous path. And often, even on the ordinary path up there, the Sherpas fall down the mountains and die, trekkers fall down, it's quite treacherous, not to mention gnats, you know. I nearly fell down. Were you there when I nearly fell down and then, what's his name? Australian bloke, what's his name?
Craig.
Craig, sorry.
No, Craig, sorry. I heard about it.
I know. The yak didn't got me, you know, and Craig grabbed me. And the porter of the yak got mad at me for being stupid and upsetting the yak, which is true, I think. I got nervous, you know. Anyway, it didn't fall down, anyway. Harry's story is much more dramatic than mine. That was a dumb one. This you'll see what I was saying with Harry. So what happened was he's walking up there, and very treacherous, and suddenly he sees these four porters. Have you ever been up there? And we saw we have 11 porters, because 32 people go up to the mountains. We have 11 porters, skinny little Sherpas, they wear their flip-flops, you know, we all wear our fancy walking boots, you know. These Sherpas with their big packs, and a friend of mine used to do it, and he said, Ravina, all you do is see your feet. And I can't even see with even no pack, because it's so difficult. You trip over something, you always look at your feet. I never managed to see the mountains, because you can't look at the mountains, you fall over. So I never saw anything except my feet, you know. So, and they had 60 kilos on their backs, these dudes. They had 60 kilos. Honestly, unbelievable. You can't believe it. And that's like their choice, that's their job, they love it, they have some whatever. So we had 11 of them. So here there's four Sherpas walking down, these are four porters, and there was something very close and very intense and very narrow. No time for anything. So the first thought he had, okay, four of them, one of me, I'll step to the side. So this is pointing out to, in all these meditations, in the exchange yourself for others, all these different techniques you use to kind of, it's sort of almost like logic to argue with ego, to trick ego. Because the natural instinct is I'm me, 47 people there, but I'm me, so you know, four people, normal one is four people coming, it's a big treacherous mountain, I'll close a treacherous cliff, and I'll get to the edge of the mountain, and hope they fall, hope they pass, and if they fall, it's not my fault. You know, like this, isn't it? But immediately, the thought arose to put them first. Now, we hear stories like this. What I'm trying to point out to you is this one. When we hear about very special people, kind people, we think they're kind of good, we think they're sort of like potluck. It's kind of born that way, and there's no logic to it. It's a bit like seeing someone play the piano for the first time, but it's just pot luck. No, it's hard practice. So if you haven't practiced much in this life, you've obviously bought it from before. Well, Harry, this is to me a logical deduction. He's been a meditator and done all these meditations and has accomplished them. Like, we think of meditation as you close your eyes and some special vision comes. But then you get out of your meditation and it all goes again. Like, so if you put your hand on the piano, you suddenly play a lovely piece, and I say, play it again, please. Oh, no, I can't do that. It's just once. That's how we think of experiences. But this is solid, constant, hard work to the point where you realise things and you know, unless you forget practicing it, you retain it. So he had accomplished this extraordinary thing. So immediately, without second thought, these four strangers, not his children, spontaneous, humbly. He wasn't going, oh, I'm going to step to the side of the mountain to let you pestilential people come, aren't I holy? No, he stepped to the side of the cliff, close to the cliff. He's got his pack on, 20 kilos or something, you know. And then he notices very quickly, he says, he's got very close, very tense. And he said, if they knock me, I won't hold on. Now, excuse me, that's not natural. In the, or, having ordinary passions of anger and self-centeredness, it is not natural to be prepared to fall over and stick with someone else, if they're strangers especially. That's kind of weird. That's the fruit of his meditation. That's, he, you can argue he's accomplished his tonglen. He's accomplished it. He's perfected it. So what happens is they knock him, and he doesn't hold on. And his pack on his back, and he's falling. His feet are on the ground, so he's falling. And then he said, this is his words, I had a psychic vision of the entire fall. I saw my body crash to the ground. And then he said, I felt the hands of Geshe Lama Khonsa very forcefully pushing him. So he reversed direction and he fell into the shivers. Well, I like that story. First of all, for me that's the proof of the pudding. Like if you see Federer play tennis, that's the proof of the pudding that he's practiced, isn't it? Not just he woke up one morning and played tennis, that's superstition. It's practice. This is the proof of the pudding. He must have practiced these things for years. He's been under his cave for years and meditating. But there's the proof of the pudding. You see happy, friendly Harry walking around, you see a friendly guy. And that's the proof of the pudding, you know. Spontaneous thought that arose after years and years of practice. He genuinely, obviously had accomplished putting others first. Right there. No second thought. No drama. Nothing. Second, even the point that he's actually able to do this. Second, without a second thought, happening in his life. There was no drama queen. You know, it was just spontaneous. So we have to deduce these, by some muscle realizing this, we have to deduce these certainly about self-charity. That's the consequence of this practice. And then, of course, from this, we have to deduce he must have been bodhicitta. No question. And this also tells us, you know, the power of being to, like, get on a cultural. And this is the point in all the teachings. When we take the view that consciousness is not physical, this beginning is endless. We take the view that delusions and adventitious are not at the core of our, they're not at the core of our being, they're not there. We have to take the view that he must have removed those delusions. We have to take the view that he's realized emptiness. We have to take the view that he's cultivated bodhicitta. We have to take the view that he's developed this incredible power, it's all in the texts, to manifest his own mind spontaneously according to his own wishes, because he's so powerful and wise and compassionate. This is all fitting with the teachings. Mystical as far as we're concerned, that he's able to manifest his body when he's needed to help others. This is what they talk about bodhisattva. Even the lowest level bodhisattva can manifest his mind in 100 different forms simultaneously. A dog here, an ant there, whatever. That's how they talk. But this is just mystical and science fiction if we don't understand the logic of it all, which is the whole of the system, the explanation, which takes time to study, of course. So, away you go. Any questions?
Yeah. My husband and I were out late one night in the bush, and a kangaroo came out.
Okay, we were driving through the bush one night, and a kangaroo came out. My husband wasn't able to avoid it. It was killed, and we got away with just, I got sprayed with some broken glass. He was narrowly missed by the side mirror, and of course the car was damaged. Now, just prior to that, I got fed up with my mind, which was very busy, so I had been focusing for about 10 minutes Om Mani Padme Hum for all the creatures, right, all the sentient things,
yes,
in the bush.
Before the kangaroo hit.
Yeah, yeah. And I have discussed this with another person this morning, and I'm thinking how extremely fortunate we were, because the kangaroo could have hit the middle of the windscreen and killed us both. And I also, we didn't stop, so I kept praying for the kangaroo.
How would you know it died if you didn't stop?
I didn't know it had died at that point, and my husband didn't stop, and I'm not very good at telling him to do what I want. I might have persuaded him to stop, at least to say a prayer over it.
So
the question is, how do you see karma working in that situation?
What do you think? What's your assessment? What are you suggesting? You're suggesting because you're doing the mantra that saved your life.
I'm ignorant about the power of mantras.
I can't say anything. But all I can do say is that karma is very intricate. And you know, if it was 1 second earlier or later, something else would happen. So a whole bunch of conditions come together, seemingly randomly, isn't it? But it's never random, it's due to past karma. So everything you do affects the result, doesn't it? Everything you do. If you're sitting there having angry thoughts, it might have been different. Everything counts, every piece, every component in that moment does have an effect. So that's just logic. So that's all I can say. I can't say more.
No, that's fine. I've understood it correctly. So good. Thank you.
No, I didn't say that. You're thinking that by saying...
You are.
No. What do you think I'm saying?
My thought was...
What are you thinking I'm saying? Well, you said I understood it correctly, which means you're thinking I'm saying a certain thing. So what do you think I'm saying that makes you think what you're thinking is right? So what do you think I'm saying?
My expression meant that I understood the experience. To say, the experience was that because I was at least having some body tutor for the sentient beings before it happened, that perhaps there was less harm to
them. I didn't say that. Okay. I said the general statement, the natural statement, like you have a seed in the ground, if there's a certain amount of rain, it'll affect the way it grows. Another amount of rain will cause something else. Right? Everything counts, so that all the conditions make a difference, don't they?
Yes.
You accept that?
Yes, I do.
So all I'm making is a statement, the flat statement, that whatever, all the conditions, including what's in your mind, the time, the place, the kangaroo, the karma, all of these conditions come together and produce a certain result. So what I'm saying is every one of those conditions does play a role. I'm saying that much, and I'm not making any more statements. I'm not saying more. Do you see what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying, and I would accept that, yes.
That's all I'm saying. So in other words, it could be true that because you're saying, oh, I'm not going to be home, it could be so, but I'm not saying it for sure. But logically, everything that happens in any situation all comes together. If you put the cup in the oven 1 second longer, it will come out a different shape than doing a pottery, isn't it? Everything counts. Everything makes a difference because it's a dependent arising. Do you see my point?
Yes,
it's
I do.
It's not impossible what you're saying. Of course it's not, and I couldn't have said it intuitively. And nor could you unless you're still watching.
Yes, I do.
Good.
Thank you.
Questions? Points?
So there's no such thing as good luck?
No such thing as good luck. That's exactly the point. Like in horticulture, like in math, like in every other natural law, that's exactly the point that was made. No such thing as good luck. Can't be. Or bad luck. Everything is, karma is a natural law within which the law of which within the lives and minds of all sentient beings play out. Whatever's in the garden is what plays out in the law of botany. It's a way of saying it, isn't it? That's absolutely a given to the Buddhist monk. And that really takes us time to think. Because the default assumption we have is that it is just good luck and bad luck. That's how we act in our daily lives, and that's the source of most of our pain and suffering. Really believing this. If you have faith in God, who's got God's law, and God has it, and I'm not criticizing you, if you have faith in a creator who has got a plan, you know you don't need to know the plan, you have faith. That's better than thinking there's no reason, quite frankly. Are you going to hear my point here? I don't criticise religion, not at all. I criticise the bad part of religion, where people can misuse it for their own benefit. I call the abusive priest and everything. This is monstrous. But the actual concept of having faith in a superior being who has a plan who runs the universe, that will make you peaceful, because you know that at least some have got a plan. But the materialist view, there is no plan, it's just chaos. We even think chaos is scientific. No wonder we suffer. Can you see the point I'm making? The Buddhist one, the karma one, is we created it, so we better start to learn the plan, baby. We're the guardians. You better learn botany real quick. Because everything is natural law. There's no such thing as good luck, bad luck, and here. Interesting point. Any questions? More questions before we finish?
Could you talk a bit about disease and karma, please, Robina?
What's happening?
Diseases like cancer and...
What about...
What's the connection to karma?
What do you think, later? What I just said now? Happiness comes from virtue and suffering comes from non-virtue. So what's your obvious deduction?
Oh, it's an imbalance of some kind.
What? That's your thing. I've never said word imbalance. That's amazing. You made that word up. I don't say that.
No.
If everything that happens in the universe is not natural, is not good luck and bad luck, if everything that happens to every sentient being in the universe is a result of their past actions, what kind of actions would cause you to get cancer? And what kind of actions would cause you to have good health? It's logic. What do you think? Think simply. You can't deduce.
No.
You can't.
No.
So you've not heard me say happiness and suffering.
Well,
you've never heard me use the words happiness and suffering.
Yeah, of course.
Can you look at the whole universe and see that we have happiness and we have suffering? Can you look at, in general, you can say,
yes, thank you.
So then, the Buddha's view is that everything you experience is called suffering as a result of one of your negative actions. Everything you do, everything you experience is called happiness as one of your negative, as a result of one of your virtuous actions. So now you can deduce, can't you?
Yep, sure.
And it's usually, it's called the environmental result. The environmental result of killing is that you
get killed.
The experience similar to the cause result of killing is you die young or you get sick, so it's that result. Or you've got a lot of ill health, and whatever you eat, that's environmental. Whatever you eat harms you instead of nourishes you, that's environmental result of killing. And that'll be both of those.
Right.
Do you understand?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. And good health is a fruit of non-killing, and living a long life is a fruit of non-killing. The wish not to kill is the fruit of non-killing. So we can see we have all the mixture. You can be born in this life with a wish to kill, but you might not get killed. You can be born in this life with no wish to kill, but you'll get killed. Because all the four tracks of karma aren't all unified. They're all separate tracks, all separate from other times, other lives, all come together in one life. That's why good things happen to bad people, and bad things happen to good people. So I don't really teach anything to any questions, or emptiness to any questions. Because we've covered everything, really. There's nothing more than say.
What
just before the break, you kind of
made
a summation of.
Hang on.
Do
you
have a voice? No. Just before the break, you made a summation of the way we adhere to the middle way by determining how objects, or phenomena, everything is conventionally existent.
Yep.
And then how
the energy in here. Exactly.
And then you tied that up with karma and its results and our relationship to that and bodhicitta. Could you please just do that again?
That's not quite. Okay, that was a bit. There's a few things missing in between there. So first of all, from the point of view of reality and wisdom side, the energy without the bodhicitta side, then we look at the two truths. Okay. In general, Buddha's saying these delusions in our mind cause us to not be in touch with reality. The delusions in our mind cause us to decorate on top of what is there, characteristics that aren't there. So there's a disconnect, Buddha says, between what is real and what we perceive as real. That's the disconnect. That's insanity. That's duality. That's samsara. That's suffering. He says we can get rid of the delusions. We can get in touch with reality. This is all the wisdom we've been talking. No discussion about bodhicitta yet. Compassion wing. So the wisdom point of view finally gets to the point. You control your body, you control your speech, you control your mind, you control the delusions, and then you get to the root delusion to uproot that one, which cuts the misconception of a separate self. So within that framework, the best way to look at it is the two truths. So we have conventional reality. So we establish the existence of a cup, a prison, a person, a clock. We establish it, we name it, we define it, we give it its function, we prove it fits the definition of its function. Now we've signed off on that's a cup, that's a prison, that's a self. Then we have to now investigate how that self, cup, prison even exists conventionally. So we look at how it's a dependent. The shorthand for conventional reality is dependent arising. Interdependence. It's a shorthand. So John Kappa puts down the three levels of dependent arising. There's many other ways of talking about dependent arising, but the three levels at which things exist in dependence upon various factors. So things exist in dependence upon causes. The example of the self, then karma is a perfect example of how I am the product of my past causes, not someone else doing it to me, poor me, which is samsaric and insanity and why we suffer. So he can take responsibility. So taking on board the logic of cause and effect as the first level of dependent arising is a powerful method to loosen the grip of ego grasping. That's just incidental. Two, more subtle, like we talked earlier, yesterday, whatever it was, the example of the capital, I have this and that, this analysis of how the Buddha says the deeper level of this ego grasping causes us to totally believe that within here, with all my walking hand in hand, like my friend Tende says, with the other parts, this is the one that I, or cups and toilets and prisons exist in dependence upon their parts. You won't find a prison, a purse, a cup, a toilet, other than the parts. There's nothing other than the parts. So we look. So Buddha says ego grasping believes there's another special little part in here walking hand in hand with the other parts, the mind, the body, that's called I, that kind of runs the show, the boss. He says there is not such a phenomenon. It's an exaggeration, a distortion, an embellishment. There is no such thing, and they have to prove that there can't be such a thing as a part called I, separate from the other parts. That's a bit of an analogy. Yes, they're trying to prove that. One has to do much more, obviously. Then we go to the subtlest level of dependent arising, which we touched on this morning, began to discuss. But then what I did was, I discussed it in the context of the bodhisattva path of the practice that was transforming problems into happiness. So the wisdom part alone, without that aspect, without the compassion aspect, this one is learning to see how a prison, for example, conventionally it's named as an ugly building, let's say my definition, an ugly building that's where you're sent when you're naughty, from which you can't escape. Good enough definition. Definitely the prisons I know fit that definition. They function in that way. So we've established conventionally that is a prison. But ego grasping and the other delusions decorate on top of that lots of things which make it concrete and absolute and different and real and self-existent and unchangeable. That's the extra components we add onto that. So what Buddha is saying is we have to use the argument of dependent arising at the subtlest level here. The third level of dependent arising is that there is no prison. First, there's no prison that isn't the result of causes. Second, there's no prison that you'll find apart from the other parts. The wire, the wardens, the prisoners, the guards, the building, the ground. That's just the parts. You won't find a special little prison that owns those parts. But because prison is nothing other than all of the coming together of those parts, then we get to the subtlest level of dependent arising, and we'll realize there is no prison. There's no inherent prison. There's no meaning there of prison that doesn't come from the mind, because prison is merely labeled prison. Prison is the name the mind imputes. Prison and the definition of prison are the words we use, the meaning we give, that we impute upon the valid base, that ugly place from which you can't escape, where you're sent when you're naughty. That's the valid base, and the label prison is imputed upon that. So that's the meaning, finally, of subtle dependent arising. That's the analysis, a simple example. So what that leads you to is the conclusion of emptiness. Therefore, there is no prison from its own side. Therefore, there is no intrinsic essential prison. Therefore, there is no self-existent prison. Therefore, these are all synonyms. Therefore, there is no inherent prison. There is no intrinsic prison. There is no self-existent prison. There is no independent prison. There is no prison independent of the mind that calls it prison. The other thing is too, this is the subtlest one, the actual meaning. This finally leads to the real meaning of emptiness. So these two truths, on the face of it right now, the Buddha says, we've got the two wrong views, the two extreme views. We have the view that as soon as we hear there is no prison from its own side, we throw out the baby with the bathwater and go, oh, well, there's no prison, nothing matters anyway, it's all empty. We just threw the baby out with the bathwater. We threw out too much. That's the extreme view of nihilism. In particular, the self. Oh, well, there's no self, so I might as well kill myself anyway, it doesn't matter, who cares, nothing matters. That's the nihilistic view, and that's one of the commonest misconceptions in the world about intimate. It's way more nuanced and more intricate than that. That's extreme view, that's how we go now. From the other extreme view, every time you hear that there is a prison that does exist in dependence upon causes, conditions, parts, and newly labeled, we go, oh, thank God there is a prison. Grasp. So here we over-exaggerate prison. This is the eternalistic view, kind of like the excitement attachment energy view. This is the depressed, want to kill myself view. And this is the emotional component of these two views. We go between these views 1,000 times a day, up and down like yo-yos. All these attack extreme manifestations are rooted in this issue of grasping. So we have to practice by understanding the two truths. Whenever we think, there is no I from its own side. There is no inherent I. There's no I that can be seen as independent of the past, the causes of my mind calling it that. Instead of falling into the abyss of the great mistake, we say to ourselves consciously, ha-ha, Rabina, that means there is an I that does exist, dependent upon causes, parts, and the mind labeling. So these two are finely balanced to support each other rather than contradict each other, which is the usual extreme views that we have. So the way they're talking, as you more and more realize that dependent arising not only contradicts emptiness, it proves emptiness. And every time you think that emptiness not only contradicts dependent arising or existence, it proves existence. It's not evident immediately. We have to practice that. Then we guarantee we're going to move in more and more towards the middle way, where eventually dependent arising and emptiness will be understood to mean essentially the same thing. Well, they're the flip sides of the same coin. That's the perfect way to use these two together to help us understand reality conventionally and ultimately. Okay?
So that, like, then you talked about compassion, and I was
okay,
trying
so
to...
Then, then what I did was I tried to talk about that one of meaning labels, the subtlest meaning labels, in the relationship to the bodhisattva path, where we're trying to rip out delusions to help sentient beings, right? And then I used the idea of transforming problems into happiness. So one of the logics of transforming problems into happiness, when you understand there's no inherent prison, there's no inherent this or that, then you can see the good things in prison instead of just it's ugly, it's revolting from its own side, and I therefore have to be miserable, no choice. And I use the example of some of my friends who are happy in prison. So that's the logic, because their minds are flexible and spacious. Having a fixed view, prison is evil, right? Which it is. But ultimately not, because it's newly labeled. We call it that. So if we can call it ugly, we can call it good. That's another way of putting it. So when you know you've got a sense of emptiness, you can then apply that and see when a problem comes. For ego, a problem is a disaster, isn't it? By definition, a problem is a thing you don't want. Do you agree? Do you agree with that? That's sort of attachment. But if you're practicing this view, understanding emptiness, then when you get a problem, which is incidentally labeled ugly, you're able to see it from another point of view to get the good out of it. Do you understand that? If a problem is set in stone, inherently bad in itself, I have no choice but to be miserable, and that's the ego's view of the planet. If I understand that things are empty and have no inherent nature, then I can see them from another point of view. So my friends in prison who are happy is because they've changed their mind. It's not because they've got a new mattress or the sight or the food's better. No, they've changed their interpretation, and that's the proof of emptiness. Are you hearing me? So if, this is also interesting again with how we use it in compassion teachings, if prison is intrinsically, inherently, definitely, absolutely, from its own side, ugly, you could never, ever be happy. But the proof that it isn't that from its own side is that you can see it as a good thing, an opportunity to study and practice. That's what many of my friends have done. So the conclusion is they become happy. That proves it's empty of inherent existence. Even using an example of a negative action. We did the analysis yesterday, the day before, I forget, Friday, I think, about what an action is. We broke it down into four components. So basically what we did was look at the dependent arising of a negative action. So to say, you know, say Justin's got a mouse in his house. A typical classical example of a negative action has got these four components in place. You've got the mass, first the object, second his mind involved, and there are two main parts there. His intention, I will kill the mouse, and his motivation, I can't stand the mouse, how disgusting, how dare it be in my house. That's called anger, aversion. So that's his mind involved, intention, motivation. Three, he does the action. Four, dead mouse. Roughly speaking, there's more to it than that. I'm keeping it really simple. That's a complete action of killing. Now look at this. If that were intrinsically negative, from its own side negative, bad in its nature, there could never be any other way. There could never be any other way than having a negative result. But the point is this. Let's just say, and we all know this, this is what we call euthanasia. Same scenario, a mouse. Two, his mind involved. One, intention, I will kill the mouse. Motivation, compassion. Oh my God, the poor mouse is suffering. And he thinks killing it will help it. Okay, Buddhist agrees that it might not help it. But that's his intention, that's his motivation. So compassion. Compassion. Three, he does the action. Four, dead mouse. That is a completely different entity than the first one. And what makes it different is one of those pieces is different. That's the proof of dependent arising and the proof of emptiness. Compassion, the motivation for everything we do, happens to be the main factor that determines the character of the action and the seed it plants and the fruit it brings. So mouse is dead in both cases. Shame for the mouse. Whether or not its suffering stopped, from the Buddha's point of view, it carries on and gets another life. That's the mouse's story. From just inside, or anybody else who does, the first action will be a negative action that will leave a negative seed in his mind that will ripen as much suffering in the future. Why? Because he had anger. So the whole of that action is sort of like painted by anger. And anger is the factor that determines it's a negative action in his mind. Then the next action, let's say, instead of that, is compassion. Real, genuine compassion. Then Buddha would say, how much wisdom. But real wish to benefit the mouse. Real wish to benefit the mouse. Really can't bear the poor suffering of the poor mouse and convince that he kills it and stops suffering. That's compassion. So the whole of that action is painted by the compassion. So it's a different karmic seed, a different action. That proves negative karma is also dependent arising. Negative karma is also not existing from its own side as negative. And that's what anger and guilt think negative actions are. That's why we loathe ourselves and beat ourselves. I'm a bad person. You're evil. That's proof of no dependent arising, no emptiness at all. There's nothing that exists that isn't dependent arising. That means there's nothing that exists that doesn't possess, that isn't empty of existing inheritance. Of course, it's easy to say the word, you have to, you know, learn it. Initially, these seem contradictory. They are not. So we have confidence and learn to work with these ideas and meditate on it until the penny drops, even conceptually. So the point is, as soon as we hear that negative action, negative karma is empty, we say, oh, well, therefore it doesn't matter what I do. The exact opposite is the truth. Reality is, for the Buddha, everything exists because they're empty. Not in spite of. Because empty is shorthand for empty of being independent. Dependent arising is that everything is interdependent. Emptiness is nothing has independence, so it's the same meaning. Something's being a dependent arising is something's lacking independence. Ego thinks everything's existing independently. We don't think we think that. That's why I have to do the analysis. There's really something quite nuanced. We've got to use right words or even open our mouth. Otherwise, how can we think about it? So when you understand that, and you're doing the bodhisattva path, and you're really wanting to rip out your delusions, the quickest way to rip out attachment is to give attachment what it doesn't want. Do you see my point? Because you're immediately, instantaneously, attachment rises. Every second, to only have the nice thing. The second the unnice thing comes, aversion arises spontaneously. So you grab it, and you turn it around, and you say, this is good. And right there, you put atomic bomb on attachment. So it's not being a martyr, it's being intelligent. Then you can see it as good. That's why that woman was happy in prison. So my friend Mitch is happy on death row. He's got a happy mind. He's reinterpreted this nightmare as something good. And we can all do that, and that proves emptiness, and it's a powerful method to rip out delusions and become a bodhisattva. Do you understand? Give compassion. These are the two wings of the bird together, wisdom and compassion. How do you do this stuff? Don't go there if you're not ready. one step at a time.
Just to clarify what you just said, yes. You are not saying that if you have a motivation, a good motivation, it's okay to kill. It's not.
No. I'm saying in an example where you kill the mouse with no wisdom of reincarnation, but with sort of a sincere motivation of compassion, no wisdom. If you don't care when you come, I am saying that. It doesn't mean, oh, therefore I'm allowed to kill you with a good motivation. No, don't kill anybody. It's using an extreme example of what is a negative action to prove that it isn't inherently negative because one piece of the components was different, called motivation. That's the real point. But don't misunderstand by saying, therefore it's okay to kill. No, that's exactly right. I'm not saying it's okay to kill. But if your motivation, and that's why even any action, killing, is not some absolute action. There's as many people in this room is as many motivations as there might be. Do you understand? So that each of the actions we do is a dependent arising. Everything within that particular environment will affect the karma that we create. So you could argue it's not such, you don't run around killing people with good motivation. And eventually, you know, but it's still pure motivation is meaning well. But as Holiness says, Lama Zopa says, meaning was not enough. You've got to have wisdom. But it's not saying, therefore, it's okay to kill. Absolutely not. Hear my point. Is that clear, people? But it's hard to hear because we think, oh, killing's bad. It is, but not inherently. That's the point. Let's say, it's easier to say when you say a virtuous action. Let's say Justin's homeless. Are you homeless, Justin?
No.
Oh, good. Okay. Let's say he's a homeless person. This is exactly the same example, but this is easy to see. This is one we understand easier. And let's say I see this homeless person. No, sorry. He's not homeless. He's rich. Sorry, wrong one. He's rich. And I'm trying to befriend him because I want his money. And he thinks I love him. He thinks I'm like, oh, we're being so kind to him. And he couldn't find his taxi money, so I'll give you $20. Oh, I have my $20, Andy. Justin, doesn't matter. And he thinks, isn't she so kind? But I'm not being kind. My motivation stinks. I'm only trying to manipulate and seduce him, so when he gets his money, he'll give me his money. It's clear I didn't create good karma then, isn't it? Therefore, generosity is the action, but it's not from its own side positive, because the motivation's lousy, it's a lousy action. It's exactly the same with negative karma. You see my point? That doesn't mean don't stop being generous, but be generous with the right motivation. You see my point, Andy? Does that make sense, people? All it's trying to point out here in particular, that even a negative action in its nature isn't inherently negative. It means that it's a dependent arising. And a virtuous nature is not inherently virtuous. I did not create virtue. He got his $20, he's happy. But I didn't create virtue. I'm manipulating, I'm lying, I'm being deceptive. Another example is obvious. Let's say he's a homeless person this time, and I walk down the street and I consciously think, that disgusting homeless person, oh, I'm not going to give him any money, but $20 falls out of my pocket. Well, he's happy, he gets his $20. I create zero karma, because my mind's not involved. And even the mouse, if Justin's in there being drunk, trying to murder me, he creates the karma of being drunk and trying to murder me, but he stands on a mouse in the meanwhile, and he doesn't see the mouse. He doesn't create any karma of killing a mouse. How could he? Because his mind is not involved. We get no motivation. There's not even an intention.
But the action was complete.
No, it wasn't. The action to be complete has to be before the components. And the mind present in the action is the main player. If there's no mind involved. Okay, if karma means intention, the real meaning of karma is intention. Intention is the mind. If there's no intention, how can there be karma? It's logic.
What is one of the four components doing the action?
The second component is your mind does not intend to do it.
Yeah.
And have a motivation. They're the main players. The doing of it is minor. Not really. But the intention, the second part of your mind's involved, is the main thing. It's intention, I will kill. Motivation, hate mice. Intention, I will give $20. Motivation, generosity. That's where the karma is created. Karma is, the real meaning of karma is mental action. And that's intention. I will. That runs the universe. Can you hear? But we want to think, nah, still negative. There has to be some bad karma. Now, karma here, there's no mind involved. They debate this. But if karma is intention, intention is mind, mind's not there, follows no karma. Logic. Are we communicating here? The real thing here is trying to say between them rising. Karma just makes sense. You know, if I make a clock, it's made in many parts, right? Many things. And then it's all made and you put list all the parts. So this clock is a particular clock. But all you've got to do is do the same clock but change the font, isn't it? Or change the colour. It's another thing, isn't it? So there's two clocks, but they're each different according to the different parts. So every action we do has got many parts. One is the intention, one's the motivation, one's the object, one's this, one's the scenario, there's more than just those. So every action has its own parts. So each action we do is slightly different, because depending on the part, every piece counts. So an action you do with very strong motivation of anger is different from an action you do with just mild anger. It's not an action set in stone, ticking a box, that's bad, go to hell. No, everything is nuanced and depending on many, many, many factors, on your past karma, on many things. It's so subtle. This is proving edges as much as anything. Nothing's set in stone. Everything is dependent on arising. Even though I said about a plant, just for one day the temperature goes up 5 degrees more, then you can definitely have an effect on the way the plant grows. Everything affects everything. Nothing's set in stone. You can't say you have a flooding rain and the rose will turn out beautiful. That proves it's an inherent rose. There's no such thing. Everything's dependent. And that's how you become a Buddha, by understanding.
Is it on the right track, Rabina, to think a plane couldn't fly if it wasn't for emptiness?
That's right, exactly.
Great.
Nothing could exist if it weren't a dependent arising and therefore empty, lacking inherent existence. Exactly right. Nothing could exist if it weren't empty of inherent existence. The words don't immediately convey that to us, but we have to unpack them and understand them properly. That's the essence of the wisdom wing. And the essence of the compassion wing is this one of those changes of our and bodhicitta. And the two help each other. The more you work on lessening ego, the more compassionate you become. The more you actively work on compassion, the more it cuts ego. They work beautifully together. That's why I'm learning these two words. Compassion on its own, not enough. This one is own, not enough. Okay. Oh, excuse my fault. Okay, well, I think we can finish now. I don't know.
Yeah.
Why not? Food for thought. So we think, you know, the Buddha's view, nothing goes astray. Every one of these thoughts we've had since 2 days, 3 days has gone in. It's a great relief, really. It's, you know, it's all stored in memory. You know, your hard drive's containing all of it. You can access it. So let's nourish also these thoughts, also the things we've heard and the way we process it have sown seeds in the mind. So we maybe nourish these seeds. And this moment forward, on our path, heading to Buddhahood, no matter what route we take, you know, we're sort of paving our way to Buddhahood, things like that. Paving our way to become the person we really are. This marvelous potential, this oak tree. So, for our sake and the sake of others, how fantastic. We're so delighted to 2.5 days of delicious gardening. You know, so, keep moving, using our noggin, using our common sense, looking what's in front of us, adjusting our mind, changing our body, changing our speech, reaching out to others, gradually, growing our amazing potential. For our sake and the sake of others. Que vai vir o